listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. What is it about Mahler's music that moves us so profoundly, that touches us in such a personal way? That's the question posed by the LA Philharmonic's Mahler Project, which is now underway. I'm sure many of you have attended some of it in honor of the 100th anniversary of Gustav Mahler's death. Gustavo Dudamel and the LA Philharmonic, along with the Simón Bolívar Symphony Orchestra, have embarked on a multi-continent, Mahler-centric journey, playing all nine of Mahler's completed symphonies in both Los Angeles and Caracas, Venezuela. And Aloud and the Library Foundation is very proud to partner with the Los Angeles Philharmonic tonight for a discussion with a prolific cultural commentator and award-winning novelist, Norman Lebrecht, whose latest book is Why Mahler? It's a challenging new interpretation of the most influential composer of modern times. And to do the honors as interlocutor is Deborah Borda, President and CEO of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. We are just really delighted to welcome them both here tonight. They will be in conversation here, and then they will open up to you for questions. We would appreciate if those really were questions. We do record for podcasts, so we'll ask that you wait until the microphone comes around to you. And then after the program and the Q&A, there will be a book signing in the lobby with books for sale courtesy of our library store. Norman Lebrecht has written several best-selling works of nonfiction, including The Maestro Myth and Who Killed Classical Music. He writes regularly for Bloomberg.com and the Wall Street Journal, and he presents the Lebrecht Interview series on BBC Radio 3 and The Record Doctor on WNYC. And he blogs about everything from how a viola soloist deals with ringtone interruption, Saddam Hussein's music teacher, and a farewell to Etta James on a blog with one of the greatest names ever, The Slipped Disc. I really liked that. So cool. Prior to becoming president and CEO of the Los Angeles Philharmonic in 2000, Deborah Borda was executive director at the New York Philharmonic and general manager of the San Francisco Symphony. And as executive producer here, she's implemented the LA Live concert transmissions to more than 500 movie theaters. Under Deborah Borda's leadership, the orchestra is building new bridges to the community. Tonight is one of them, and among them, the educational initiative YOLA. And you'll be able to hear an exciting discussion about this youth orchestra and the inspiring music education system, El Sistema, and how it changes lives through music, coming up on another Aloud program, February 2nd, with author Tricia Tunstall and LA Philharmonic Education Director Lenny Borsten. So make your reservations soon. It's almost full. Now, it is a great pleasure. Please join me in welcoming Norman Lebrecht and Deborah Borda to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Norman, welcome.
Thank you so much. You know, it's been so long since I've been here.
I know.
I think the last time I was here, Ernest Fleischman was in your job and Esa-Pekka Salonen was learning to shave.
I haven't learned that yet. Anyway, welcome to everybody who's here. Well, here we are at the start of, if I could use a sort of Mahlerian metaphor, a mountain climb, which, of course, we all know he enjoyed tremendously. We are scaling the peak of the 9.5 Mahler symphonies. And what has been quite remarkable to me is the kind of public resonance that this has achieved. And I have to say, we are assiduous at the Los Angeles Philharmonic about avoiding great anniversaries. And we are sometimes chided about that in the press, that we have recently avoided the Chopin anniversary and Liszt and this and that. Now, next year, I should say, we will do the Lutoslawski 100th anniversary, so that's more us. But Mahler, somehow, we couldn't avoid it. And so where I wanted to start, and it has to do really so much with your book, is that Mahler, in so many ways, really embodies the zeitgeist of Van der Sieg, Vienna. The cast of characters, I mean, if we, you know, it's a Hollywood cast. It's real, it defines historic intersection. Alma, Mahler, Mahler himself, Freud, Wittgenstein, Herzl, Gropius, Schoenberg. And is it true he attended Mahler's funeral?
Schoenberg, yes. Yeah, he made the picture, and he went home and he wrote five little piano pieces, one of which is a reminiscence of the funeral.
Where the sun apparently came out.
The tolling bell, right. Yes.
Yes, right. It was a very cloudy day, pouring rain, and the sun came out, and there was a rainbow at the last moment. Now, in your book, you make a very strong assertion, which is that perhaps Mahler, not perhaps, Mahler has replaced Beethoven in terms of a place in our central cultural or emotional discourse. So you wrote a whole book about this, but a simple answer to why does Mahler resonate so strongly in the 21st century? Why Mahler and why now?
Okay. Why Mahler? Because you couldn't apply that question to any other composer. Why Beethoven? It's obvious. Why Bach? Why Mozart? Why Lutoslavsky? Yeah, there is no answer except the fact of the matter. Why Mahler? You're dealing with a phenomenon that's unique in the history of music. Never has a composer derided in his lifetime, discarded for almost a century afterwards, after his death, returned to become the center of the conversation, to displace Beethoven at the center of the symphonic process. So why Mahler? What is it about this guy? Is it because he is a fulcrum of what George Steiner called the crucible of civilization, Vienna, at the turn of the 20th century? Is it that he was so involved with everyone from Klimt to Freud in a society that was changing and creating our world? Is it that because when he left Vienna and everybody gathered at the railway station at 8:15 that morning, Mahler was going to America, and as the train pulled out, Klimt said that famous word, "Vorbei, it's over, Mahler's gone." Is it that? Is it because he's one of the makers of modern culture? Or is it something even more profound, that he actually feels part of today? That he seems, in his music, Mahler said, "My time will come." Well, we all say that. Deborah's been saying that for as long as I've known her. But in his case, it does rather seem to be true that so many of the things that are there in his music, so many of the things that we see and hear and relate to in his music, which are not actually expressed but are suggested, seem to be the issues that we're grappling with in our daily lives today. Issues of minorities in a multicultural society, issues of relationship breakdown, issues of the work-life balance. All of these things, they are not just in Mahler, but in his music, because of his music, he said, it must embrace everything. And so there is something about Mahler that feels extraordinarily contemporary to us, and flexible, and open to constant interpretation. Mahler, of course, was one of the great conductors of all time. And as a composer, he said, as very few composers to do, to members of the conducting profession, if it doesn't work for you, change it. He gave a license for interpretation, and the license is not just to musicians, but also to those who interpret the life and the work as I am doing. And if you want to know how easy it is to bend Mahler, oh, let me just play it. Can I play a track of music? Is that all right? Can we play track number two up there and This is one of the songs from Kindertortenlieder, okay? But it's not quite the way Mahler wrote it. Could you do that with a Schubert song?
Yes.
With some difficulty. You couldn't do it with Schumann.
No.
You couldn't do it with Brahms. You couldn't do it with... There is something in Mahler that we are able to make our own, to repossess, to recreate, and to reincarnate. And as Uri Kane has done in that particular track, we understand where Mahler is coming from, and we feel as if he and his issues are somehow here with us right now.
You know, I agree. If you listen to Beethoven, it feels very much of a museum piece. And although it's more than 100 years with Mahler, it does feel now. And we'll talk a little bit about, I think, some of the different emotional twists and turns. But when you think about Mahler and as you read about him in your book or you read other, he's a man who pushed himself and pushed others. He pushed the public beyond what they saw as their constraints of tolerance. Six movement symphonies, 100 minutes, these enormous pieces that were almost a fantasy. He pushed orchestras and soloists. He demanded they play in tune, in time, and be very rigorous. He pushed himself. He would go to work with 104 fever. And yet, he had the most powerful position in Vienna at the time, the head of the Vienna Opera, and yet he was under constant critical attack, not only for his conducting, but for his composition. He said, "My time will come," so famously, but what is it in this man who is deeply neurotic and depressive and creative that gave him the resilience in the face of such remarkable resistance to be, on some level, optimistic?
There is something a little bit messianic about Mahler. He actually believed that if he got it right in music, that if he got to the bottom of this, he could crack the secret of creation. He could show how the universe came into being and make sense of it, because as he saw it, it didn't make sense. There was so much injustice. There was so much that was horrible and appalling. There was so much that was directed at him that was poisonous and awful. He had that sense of mission, and the mission was, to a degree, messianic. I've got to do this because this is what I've been put on earth for. And you talk about his working day. I mean, you work fairly hard. I work fairly hard. You wouldn't know what his day was like. Okay. I mean, and I've paced out pretty much everywhere that Mahler ever was. When you talk of climbing mountains, I've climbed those mountains. I've lost my head for heights. they're pretty tall. He gets up in the morning around 8. He has breakfast with Alma. He walks to work. It takes 12 minutes. He gets into work before 9 o'clock. He writes or dictates. He's running the biggest opera house in Europe. He writes or dictates up to 50 letters a day. He's having meetings. He's got a queue of people waiting at his door. He's got singers wanting to take a week off so they can earn more money somewhere else. He's got replacements to tonight's cast because so and so has fallen sick. He's got all of these things going on. Doors are slamming. He's shouting at people. Other people are shouting at him. At 11:30, he goes downstairs. He conducts a rehearsal. 1 o'clock, he leaves, walks home. Either goes to the Café Imperial for lunch, or if Alma's made dinner, he goes home. He has a 20-minute nap. Then he walks back to the opera house, usually in the company of a professor from the University of Vienna, because he's lined up a whole load of scholars who have to keep him abreast of the latest developments in their particular science, because he has this insatiable curiosity about the world. He gets back to the office at 4 o'clock. He does another 90 minutes of dictating letters and shouting at people and being shouted at and telling singers they can't do what they want to do. And at 5:25, he changes his jacket for the other one in the cupboard and he goes downstairs and he conducts Tristan. And that's till 11 or 11:30. That's a day's work.
You know, this sounds like a day at the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
That's a day's work. So he pitches at it with a fanaticism. And then during the long summer break, he has 3.5 months break. It's not a total break because people are constantly coming out to see him from the opera. His secretary comes twice a week with the papers that need to be seen to and casting and so on and so forth. But during those 3.5 months, he's at his summer home and he is trying and hoping and praying that he's going to get a symphony out of it. He doesn't write anything except symphonies. When he does songs, he usually does them, almost invariably does them for a purpose. They're sketchbooks for symphonies. And people ask, why did he only write symphonies? Why did he never write an opera? Why did he never write any chamber music or anything like that? Well, he didn't write an opera because that was the day job and he wanted to get away from that in summer. And he didn't write anything else. He didn't write anything small because the things that he did had to matter. It had to be, it was the symphony or nothing. That's what he did.
I recently read, maybe you've read it, a book, and it's been very popular, The Hair with the Amber Eyes by Edmund Duval. And I was just struck by certain aspects of it. And, you know, here you have these remarkable, the House of Effrusi and the Rothschilds and Vienna at that time, actually. And we all know about anti-Semitism, but the level of anti-Semitism was so remarkably vicious that it is not just a harbinger, but it is the moment of Hitler almost feels that it's there in Vienna at that time. Now, for Mahler to get the appointment as head of the Vienna State Opera, he actually, as we know, had to convert to Catholicism. And I was wondering, as you've researched this, as he did it, was it a purely pragmatic act, or did it injure his soul? Was there an emotional toll? I mean, this is a huge, sort of like signing a McCarthy statement or something.
Huge emotional toll. Huge emotional toll. There is a word in German for what he did. It was called a Karrieretaufe, a career baptism. There was only one job in the world that he wanted and one job that he knew that he could do better than anybody else, and that was being director of the Vienna Opera. He couldn't actually apply to be director. He had to apply to be fifth conductor. And even in order to get that job, he had to be baptized because it was the court opera, and the court was the court of the Holy Roman Empire, and officials above the level of fifth conductor all had to be Roman Catholic. So he undertook a short course of instruction in Hamburg, and he was baptized in the little Michaelskirche. We know exactly what his feelings were, because he bumped into a couple of guys as he came out of the church. And to one of them he said, I've changed my jacket. That's what he meant. Okay. And to the other one he said, I have a lot of sympathy for Catholicism. I grew up in a town where, as a Jewish boy, I would also sing in the church. There were close relations between the communities. We weren't always friendly, but we understood each other. And I have a sentimental attachment to a lot of Catholic ritual and liturgy. But I hate it. I loathe it. I deplore it that I've been forced to do this. Those were his feelings.
But would you say he was a religious man?
He was.
Maybe in the terms of spirituality.
Deeply religious.
That's my sense as well.
Deeply religious. And the word given to it both by one of his closest disciples from Los Angeles, Bruno Walter, who died here in Los Angeles. Actually, two of the people closest to him worked here, Otto Klemperer, Bruno Walter.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit. Yeah. One thing we wanted to get into, the Los Angeles connections.
We had to work in the local interest. this goes into the Metro pages. And another conductor called Oscar Fried. Both Walter and Oscar Fried used the same noun to describe Mahler. They said, er war Gottsucher. He was a God seeker. He was constantly looking for the divine in everything that he did and in the world around him. He searched for God. So to say that he was a believer understates it. He was a fanatical searcher.
You know, there, we know that Mahler came from a very difficult background. How many of his siblings died of the family?
8 out of 14. Okay.
And then there's a sort of, I think psychoanalysts would call it a panel memory, but it's a pivotal memory in his life, which is his father, who was a bit of a difficult guy, is fighting with his mother, and there's just an absolute screaming in the house. He rushes from the house, very upset, and he stands in the street, and there's an organ grinder. Mm. And he's playing Ach du lieber Augustin. And
they're not paying us to sing, Deborah.
Pardon me?
They're not paying us to
sing. Well, me especially not, yeah. Maybe you.
We can do it. Yeah.
But we like, the managers, whenever they get a chance, we like to sing or play. Or dance. And this has a profound effect upon him And you hear it, these juxtapositions later on throughout his music. But as his life develops, I mean, you have to say he's, I mean, maybe you don't agree. What you might think, though, that he's neurotic.
Mm-hmm.
He's a terrible hypochondriac who's actually sick. It's one of those horrible things when he's, I'm not well, and then they die. You know? And so he consults a man of his time, Sigmund Freud. And it was an emergency consultation, clearly, because Freud is in Leiden on a holiday. And he goes to see Freud, and he talks about one of his problems is withholding his libido, which is a very nice way of putting it. But what's the real story of that interaction? What do you think actually happened from
your
research?
We know what happened. It's one of the great conversations of the century. And it's a historic moment, because it's the only time a shrink has ever seen a patient in August. Freud was inclined to break his own rules. It was the longest consultation Freud ever gave. It was 4.5 hours. And it would have gone on longer, except he had to catch the last tram back to where his family was staying in an adjacent resort. It was also, it was a moment of mutual intuition. Freud said later that nobody had understood him so instantaneously and profoundly as Mahler had done. And Mahler drew things from what Freud was telling him that enabled him to find a way of continuing in a difficult marriage in which his wife was seeing a much younger man. So it was a transaction that worked for both men and had profound influence on both of them. What actually happened, we know, because Freud was quizzed about it some years later by a lady called Marie Bonaparte, who was princess of Denmark and Greece and was actually the aunt of our own Prince Philip. She was a... Freud was very impressed that he was getting a great niece of Napoleon as one of his patients and later as one of his trainees. And she was... she pretty much founded psychoanalysis in France. And she was able to ask Freud about almost everything. Nobody had such access to Freud as Marie Bonaparte. The only thing he refused to discuss with her were his own sexual relations with his wife. When she asked about that, he said, I'm going out for a smoke. So when it came to Mahler, Freud actually gave her chapter and verse, and she would go back to her room and she would write it down. So we know verbatim what went on between them. Mahler was in a state of despair. He felt he was losing his wife, which would mean losing his child, and he would die alone. He had a horrible fear of dying alone, and he would do anything to get her back, and seeing Freud was one way of doing that. And Freud explained to him that he had various burdens of guilt, that he'd married a woman so much younger than himself, that he needed to encourage and give her freedoms that he had willfully suppressed, that he needed to be more considerate of her needs and accommodate himself to work to what she wanted from the marriage rather than what he wanted. And Freud then took his whole life history and made these little aperçus about that the way that the Ach du lieber Augustin melody comes in, and that it's a mixture of comedy and of sorrow, and that the song itself, although it's played in the street as a street jingle, is actually a song which commemorates people who died in the plague. It twists in and out. It has every kind of connotation. And of course, in Mahler's music, you have every kind of connotation. So Freud came pretty close to understanding where Mahler was going in music. And Mahler came out of that session exhilarated. And he sent telegrams to Alma telling her, it's all right, we're saved, we're going to be together. I've worked it out for us. Don't we all do that in our relationships? I've worked it out for us.
So do you think he was recanting from the letter he sent her, when his proposal letter, saying, you will dedicate yourself entirely to me, you will do this as my wife, you will cook meals at this time, you will be my, you will worship me.
To a considerable degree, and on the train home, he wrote her a poem in which he references that. The poem is seeded with coded references to the whole of their life together and to the restrictions that he imposed on her at the beginning. So he hasn't recanted,
But he has accommodated it. He's accommodated his own shortcomings in the urge and in the need to repair the relationship and to hold them together. It worked.
Do you think Freud ever heard any music of Mahler?
No. Freud never heard any music.
Well, he like Lennon, Magic Flute, I think it was the one piece he liked.
He went to Magic Flute and then he didn't go again.
Once.
once.
I went once.
I did. I've been to the opera. Like Lenin, who adored Beethoven but wouldn't listen to Beethoven, he said it would distract me from my greater purpose in life. With Lenin, it might humanize me. It might stop me killing people.
Well, people clearly throughout history have felt very special connections to Mahler, and I think one man who genuinely believed that he channeled Mahler, literally, was Leonard Bernstein. And I know you had some interesting conversations with him. And I was thinking about this. Norman writes about meeting Leonard Bernstein after a concert in London, and Lenny has 3 or 4 tumblers of scotch, as he did right after a concert, and then he explains the Mahler Ninth. But, you know, in this country, Lenny in the 60s actually started to introduce us again to Mahler, and he called, you know, he said, Mahler Grooves. There were bumper stickers you could see in New York. And last night at the Mahler 3, Lenny's daughter, Jamie Bernstein, flew in just for the performance because there is such a profound connection between the Bernstein families and the Mahlers. And now actually Gustavo, and in fact the Bernsteins last year gave Gustavo the white vest that Lenny used to wear. It's quite too big on Gustavo. But we always take it out and show it.
He'll grow into it.
Yeah. So I mean, do you think Bernstein was in some ways internationally responsible or behind part of the revival? And what was his special connection, aside from neurosis?
He was hugely influential in the United States in the return of Mahler. He was hugely influential in Vienna because he conducted Vienna Philharmonic in Mahler, which they didn't like doing. They'd got out of that habit. And he brought to it a kind of empathy and a kind of personal identity. I am Mahler. Mahler is me. He did feel very strongly that affinity, that much in Mahler were the things that were motivating Leonard Bernstein. But he wasn't alone, and it would be a mistake to see him as the only force that returned Mahler to the center
of
the conversation.
Who were the other forces?
Well, I mean, at the same time that Bernstein was starting his series with the New York Philharmonic, you know, he did that cycle with the New York Philharmonic, but he did it over 5 years.
And recorded all the symphonies.
The BBC did it over 1 year, and that was the first really big Mahler cycle since the Second World War, and that brought it back in Europe. Raphael Kubelik was doing a cycle, recording a cycle in Munich at the same time as Leonard Bernstein was, so that was coming out at the same time. And then, of course, the big breakthrough was Luchino Visconti, Death in Venice, using the Adagietto from Mahler's Fifth Symphony and parts of Mahler Third, which just brought it to a world audience. It was a wonderful film. It was beautifully contextualized. Visconti was a cultural omnivore. He knew everything about Death in Venice before he did it, and he knew that in the novella, Thomas Mann had imprinted Mahler's features on Aschenbach. And so Mahler is deeply within that, and he had to take Mahler's music for it. And that really brought it into the public generality. It also distorted it, because the Adagietto became associated with death. And Leonard Bernstein was also partly responsible for that, because at the funeral of Robert F. Kennedy, Lenny conducted the Adagietto of Mahler Fifth, and everybody thought, well, it's a funeral march, isn't it? That's what it's about. And it's continued after 9/11. Radio stations switched their programs. They put on the Adagietto of Mahler Fifth. That wasn't what Mahler intended it for. It was actually intended as a love letter to the girl he was going to marry.
Yeah.
Except with Mahler, and this is one of the reasons why we feel so strongly today that Mahler is part of our complex world. With Mahler, he meant it as both. Mahler was acutely aware that we are complex organisms as human beings. We don't feel simple emotions. It's very easy in Beethoven to talk about joy and brotherhood and the unity of mankind. I mean, large, you know, large ideas and quite simple ideas, forceful ideas, but ideas that you take as slabs of granite and you put them down there. With Mahler, every idea and every emotion is equally, and Lenny said this, is equally its opposite, and several other tangential things beside. Lenny said, every truth that you can possibly say about Mahler, the opposite is equally true.
Hmm. It's interesting you bring up the case of the Adagietto.
Hmm.
At major symphony orchestras, and we do this at the Los Angeles Philharmonic, librarians are backstage every night, and they have a stopwatch, and they clock when the piece starts and then how long each movement takes, and it's entered
in the history. It's a great job. You go to library school, and you do your post-grad, and then you wind up at the Los Angeles Philharmonic with a stopwatch in your hand.
Well, that's good. No, you're going to see, though, it's actually very instructive. And they do the same thing at the New York Philharmonic, where, of course, I worked for many, many years. And this was really fascinating. I had read, and I don't know if this is true, that when Mahler conducted the Adagietto, it was about 9.5 minutes.
He did it at 7:50 once.
Oh, okay. All right, so this is...
Okay.
And now, when Leonard Bernstein conducted his final performance of the Adagietto, he clocked in at just over 14 minutes.
14, that's right. Yep.
How can there be that elasticity? And it was a great performance. I mean, people remembered it, and I'm sure Mahler's performance was perfectly good as well.
Yeah.
You know, probably not bad. How do you explain that elasticity in concept, in a piece of music, in perhaps why it's with us today?
Mahler, when he was conducting the New York Philharmonic, it drove them berserk because he would spend a whole day's rehearsal trying to get something in a particular way, and he would come in the next morning and want it different. And they would say, we had blood coming out from under our fingernails yesterday. We were playing it so slow, and now you want it fast. And he said, you have to go with the feeling. This is how I feel now. And I may feel differently in performance, but you have to be with me all the way. That's what it's about. It's about interpretation, and it's about fitting the music to the moment. So when Mahler says, my time will come, what he means is the music for the moment. And that kind of flexibility in Mahler, that ability to perceive in the Adagietto both morbidity and redemption, both love and death, and a whole host of other things besides. That innate flexibility in Mahler is what makes him a great composer, and what makes him a unique composer.
And that it can, because if you had a Beethoven symphony that had that discrepancy in performance, because, you know, if you look at performances of most major conductors, an entire symphony will have a 5 to 10 second variation on a 40-minute symphony. So it's something that we see a lot. Of course, Mahler had a pretty miserable time in New York. Toscanini edged him out at the Metropolitan Opera, and then Mrs. Sheldon, who I think I knew her, who was the head of the ladies' committee of the New York Philharmonic, and also threw him out. I mean, why did it not work there for him? You know, it should have been so triumphal.
There were too many big beasts. There were too many conflicting animals and conflicting interests. There was J.P. Morgan, who was kicking him out of the Met. There was Toscanini. The day that Toscanini's scores got taken into New York Public Library, I was there at the door waiting for it to open so I could get in and take a look at it. He had 5 of Mahler's symphonies there. None of them had been cut open. He really, really hated Mahler. It didn't work out because there were too many other people who thought they owned the New York Philharmonic, and Mahler had come along and he'd said, this isn't an orchestra. This is an educational mission. And what we're doing here, first of all, he invented thematic programming. He invented educational programming. He had a series with the orchestra that was the history of music from Bach to the present day. And he said to them, look, what we're doing here is far too important to be confined to Carnegie Hall. We need to take it up. And they said, where do you want to go? He said, Brooklyn. New York Philharmonic had never been to Brooklyn before. They started in Brooklyn.
And have never been since.
That's right. That's right. They haven't. And I think Kurt Mazur went there once.
No, the orchestra stayed home.
I remember that, Deborah. he then put the orchestra on a train. And they went to 12 different cities around the United States, and he invented orchestral touring. So he was way, way, way ahead of his time. But when we talk about him as an important composer, when we talk about him as a revolutionary composer and as a composer of our time, what we have to do is to take him out of the tram lines of music history. Pierre Boulez once said to me, the history of the development of music is really a straightforward and linear thing. It goes from Bach through Haydn to Beethoven, Wagner, Mahler, Schoenberg, Second Vienna School, Stockhausen, and myself. and, you know, he was making a reasonable argument. In the sense that music has to develop and it has to evolve, and these were the revolutionary moments in a sense. But I knew at the time, this was 25 years ago, that he had got that argument completely wrong when it came to Mahler, because Mahler isn't in the line. Mahler is a disruptor. Mahler is a breaker up of linearity and of tradition and of continuity. He starts out writing symphonies in 5 movements, 6 movements. He's going to do 7 for the 3rd symphony and just relented at the last moment. He puts an adagio at the end of a symphony. Who else? A 30-minute adagio at the end of a symphony? Who would do that? Do you want to know how he most messes with our perceptions? He does it at the very opening of his very first symphony. Can I just talk this through? Can we opening the
we
first symphony?
We might have some music.
Yeah? How are we for time?
We have time.
They're not going to throw us out till 10 o'clock, so we'll be all right. Okay, opening of the first symphony, right? He's 27 years old. He's writing his first symphony. What's that first note, anyone? Can we stop just a moment? All right? Stop just a moment. We're taking from the top. First note of the first symphony. Anyone? A, thank you very much. On open strings. All right? You're 27 years old. You really want to make your mark on the world. How am I going to do it? I'm going to do it with an A on the open strings, all right? Okay, let's start again. Please?
He's got to rewind.
Okay. Excuse me? Is this going to begin sometime? Okay. You've been working a long, hard day here in Los Angeles, and you've come to hear your young composer, your young conductor, who's also a composer. He's written his first symphony, and you're sitting back and saying, lovely. Now, keep it going. And you're sitting here, and he's giving you what? White noise. You've got... Nothing. Some distant noises, something from somewhere. But is there anything here that you can whistle on the way home? Is there a theme? Is there a song? Is there a something? Nothing. What on earth is going on here? And if you're in Budapest in 1889, you're hearing this for the first time, you're starting to get quite edgy. Do you know how long this goes on for? Any guesses? Yeah. How long does it last? How long until you get something where you can actually start singing? 4.5 minutes. 4.5 minutes of this. And if you're hearing it for the first time, you're wondering if some horrible joke is being played on you. There's only one composer who has tried this before. His name is Beethoven. He does it in the 9th symphony at the point where he's world famous and he's had the symphony commissioned by London. And do you know how long Beethoven takes before he gets to the point? 15 seconds. Okay? And here's Mahler saying, 4.5 minutes. So what is he trying to tell us? He's trying to tell us that the history of the symphony has ended and it's just about to start all over again, because what you think is music and what you've been listening to until now as music, just can just hold it down a little bit. We'll bring it up when we get to a tune. There we are. You know, just keep it running under there. That's not music at all. And why is that? Because what I need you to picture here is, here we are, it's coming. Is it coming? Up, 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 up. Morgen Übersfeld, at last, something to sing about. Thank you. All right. So what is he doing to us? Why is he messing with our minds here? What's going on? In order to understand this, you have to picture a little boy, 6, 7 years old, so terrified about what's going on at home, about the rows between his parents, his father, a rather brutal man, his mother, delicate and an invalid. There's a bar downstairs. It's a military town. There are soldiers in there. There are girls there. There are all sorts of things the little boy really shouldn't be knowing about, and they're really frightening to him. And so he runs away from home. And where does he go? He goes to the one place where you tell little boys never to go. He goes to the forest, deep into the heart of the forest. And in that forest, yeah, why would he go into the forest? It's the scariest place. There are wolves there. There are escaped prisoners. There are pedophiles. There are witches who are going to turn you into gingerbread. The worst possible things. But he goes deep into the forest, and he sits on a log, and he spends a whole long summer's day there. And he sits there until his father comes and fetches him just before nightfall and takes him home. And during the course of that day, he reinvents the definition of music. Because before Mahler, what we thought of as music was something that was frontally delivered by musicians to audience. Orchestra plays, audience listens, that's what you're getting. That's the transaction. With Mahler, from sitting in the forest, from listening to the winds, he knows that music is everything. And when he says later on to Sibelius, the symphony must be like the world, it must embrace everything, he means that it has to be three-dimensional. It has to be all the noises around. It has to be not just what the orchestra is playing, but also the squeaks, the handbag that's just dropped, the person who's snoring behind you, and the streetcar that's running outside. Everything that you hear is music. And if you isolate that, if you take that out of the context, then it's not music anymore. It's something precious, and it's artificial, and it's worthless. And I've sat on that log in the forest, and I have listened to the wind change in the top of the pine trees. And when it changes from west to east, and it starts blowing in a little bit of rain, the sound that you get through the tops of those pine trees is an A. And it sounds like an A on the open harmonic strings. So Mahler is also doing something else. He's writing autobiography in music. As well as telling us that music has to be three-dimensional, he's also saying the lessons we're going to get out of music are the lessons that I can extrapolate from my life in pursuit of some sort of universal solution. And there was one other person at that time who was doing the same thing. And he was writing about urinating on his parents' floor when he was 3 years old. And out of that, he derived the Oedipus complex. Mahler and Freud were writing off the same page. They used the materials of their own lives to seek solutions to human misery.
You feel such a personal connection to Mahler. And as I was reading the book and reading some of your commentary about it, and you took a real risk in the way that you did it, and that it isn't just your regular biography. It's part travelogue. You actually climb the mountains. You visit the places. And I think you said it's sort of a DJ's guide to Mahler. Why did you take that risk? I mean, this is a...
I didn't feel it was a risk.
You decided not to be, you know, Professor Lagrange.
I didn't feel it was a risk at all. I just felt one had to make that connection in the same way that Lenny Bernstein made that connection. First time I came to Los Angeles, I'd written a book in the 1980s called Mahler Remembered, which started out, it was going to be a biography of Mahler, but I was discovering so many texts that were either unpublished or untranslated that I thought if I put them together, they would become a sketch of Mahler, a kind of thumbnail sketch of Mahler through the testimonies of people who knew him and who worked with him, and that would be more valuable than writing my own biography at that particular time. And I wrote short introductions, and I brought it here to Los Angeles. Pretty much when it was published, I found some journalistic excuse to come here, and I took a copy to his daughter, Anna, who lived out in West L.A., and she read it overnight, and she called me back in the morning. I went out there, and she said, "This isn't a book about Mahler; it's a book about you," and in the nicest possible way, you know. And what she meant was exactly this: you, with Mahler, unlike many other composers, to get the most out of him, you really have to relate to him personally, because he is relating personally to you. It's like any other close relationship. It's like it's like a therapeutic relationship, or it's like an intimate emotional relationship. Unless you give of yourself, you cannot receive.
Before we open this up to questions, I have a last question, which is a two-part question, actually, which is, if you met Mahler today and you could ask him two questions, what would they be?
Well, the second one would be, why Mahler? And the first one I would have to choose from about 850.
Oh, give us a preview, Norman.
Okay. Well, it wouldn't be about the order of movements in the Sixth Symphony.
Gil Kaplan would ask him that.
Yeah, that's right.
The tempo in the Adagietto.
It wouldn't be about the tempo in the Adagietto, no.
I'm glad to see I've stumped you.
No,
that's unusual,
no,
I have to say.
No, you have. Do you know what it would be? It would be about the meaning of those inscriptions in the Ninth and Tenth Symphonies, where he writes these passionate cries to God and to his wife, not to leave him, not to abandon me, not to abandon him. Identification. And I would have asked him, whose eyes were those intended for? Because obviously they were intended for his wife's eyes. But then he would have known that that manuscript would have gone to someone else. It would have gone to his copyist. It would have gone to musicians. And those cries would have got out. And my feeling is that Mahler intended these most personal and agonized cries to be out there for musicians and for listeners as part of the commentary on his own work that he constantly provides. One of the other, again, I don't want to overuse the word, unique aspects of Mahler is that he provides us both with text and context. Everything in Mahler is both what it is and what you make of it. And I kind of liken it to a page of Talmud, or where, I don't know if any of you have ever seen a page of Talmud, but the middle of the page is a kind of slab of text, which will be arguments between scholars over a period of about four centuries. And then around it, there are two large commentaries, and those are commentaries about 800 years later, two major commentators. And around them, there is another ring of commentators. And then at the back of the book, there are what are called the backroom boys, who then argue with all the guys who've been arguing right the way through. So the process of analysis and interpretation and argumentation is continuous, and so it is with Mahler. With music, we often talk about clarity. We often talk about working through an idea until you have the most lucid possible access to it. With Mahler, the struggle for clarity continues after you've got clarity. And that's the continuity in Mahler. That's why Mahler now. That's why he feels so much a part of our world, because we're still making sense of him. And as long as Mahler is played, we will still be struggling to try and work out what he means, not just in 1908 or in 2012, but in 2312.
Well, we can't ask Mahler those questions, but you can ask us questions. So we will now open up the floor. I think since this is recorded, if you can wait for a microphone, and we have some wonderful microphone bearers here.
First of all, Deborah, thank you so much for bringing the Mahler Project. You've done a great service for Los Angeles.
It's been our pleasure.
Have ticket sales met your expectations, number one? Number two, do you know how many of us are attending all nine symphonies? Have you kept track of that? Mm-hmm. And number three, do you know of anybody who is attending every single Mahler concert that Dudamel is conducting?
Do you think I'm Rick Perry? Number one, we've had wonderful ticket sales. We've sold close to 5,000 tickets, for example, to the Mahler Eighth at the venerable Shrine Auditorium, but the concerts are packed. So yes, we've not only met our sales goals, but we've exceeded our expectations. So that's been very powerful. And so clearly, as we were talking about this before, this project has resonated somehow with Angelenos. Are there people, what was number two? Are there people who are going to every single performance?
How many?
You know, we don't track that. I can't tell you, but so I have to give you a sort of answer of, people I run into in the street. I've met a number of people who've told me they're going to every single symphony. I don't know anybody other than probably me who will go to every single performance, but there are many people who are attending every single symphony. And, you know, we didn't make it available, and you can get 1 through 9, and of course we're not doing them in exact order for a variety of reasons. So people had to make a point of doing this to construct it. But it's been, you sort of get the feeling in a city when something's working and when people are excited. And this has definitely created that kind of frisson. So we're very pleased about it. I sometimes wonder, was it one of the questions I was going to ask Norman was it a totally crazy idea? You know, we call it 9 symphonies, 2 orchestras, 1 conductor. Thank God he's 30. I mean, if he was any older, I don't think he could do this. Surely, and he turns 31, so we've got to get this all in now very quickly.
And nobody has ever done them so young. And one of the revelations was, of course, Gustavo doing Mahler 1 at his first concert and doing it at the age that Mahler was when he wrote it. Nobody's ever done that before. And it was so revealing.
And also an interesting thing for us is, and then we'll take more questions, is that, I mean, thinking back to at his inaugural concert in Walt Disney Concert Hall, Gustavo conducted Mahler 1, and sitting there a couple of nights ago and hearing where he has journeyed to and where the orchestra has traveled with him. Mm. The difference, I mean, it was a wonderful performance back 3 years ago, but it's a very different performance now. It's a very different performance, and that is thrilling for me, and I think for our audiences, and people hear it. You know, we have a great audience here, and people commented on that. So, next question. There we go. We see a hand. Oh, you'll get one next.
Thank you very much. This has been illuminating. You did not say anything about Das Lied von der Erde. Would you say some things about it? And would you tell us what is your favorite recording of it?
Whoa! Das Lied von der Erde is an act of synthesis of song and symphony. I said before, Mahler never wrote small pieces. He always worked towards a symphony, but he'd started writing, sketching these songs from 6th century Chinese poems at a time of personal devastation. His child had died of diphtheria. He'd lost his job in Vienna, and he had been diagnosed with a heart condition that could kill him at any time. And so the foundations of his life had been disrupted, and he had been sent a book of Chinese poems in which he was able to find some kind of consolation, and he works that consolation into the set. One of the most remarkable moments is in the upsheet, the farewell, the final section, where you can practically hear a human being disintegrating. You certainly hear the music disintegrating. The music actually fades away to the point where it can't go any further. And at that point, he brings in a resolution, a therapeutic device in which you feel the personality coming together again, resolving that life can continue, that he can find himself again. It's one of the most extraordinary moments in the whole of music. And there's so much else to talk about it, but you'll have to have me back for that. When you talk about recordings, the two classic recordings are the Kathleen Ferrier and Julius Patsak with Bruno Walter, which was done in 1950. It was an extraordinary performance with the Vienna Philharmonic. The other was Otto Klemperer with the Philharmonia and Fritz Wunderlich and Christa Ludwig. And another amazing performance, despite the fact that Wunderlich and Ludwig never met. And indeed, that by the time the record came out, Wunderlich was tragically dead. And I cherish those greatly. But the one I probably listen to for choice is Giulini. Who came not far from where Mahler actually wrote that piece, in Toblach or Dobbiaco in the Italian Dolomites, what is now the Italian Dolomites, and the two soloists that he picked, Brigitte Fassbender and
Placido Domingo.
Pardon? No, not Placido Domingo. Whose name has just gone out of my head.
Rick Perry. Call Rick Perry.
Rick Perry. Rick Perry. Thank you very much, Rick Perry.
Arezzo?
Arezzo. Thank you very much.
Arezzo.
Bravo. Arezzo. Bravo. Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Google. You didn't. Did you look for it on a device, or you remembered it?
No, but I remembered it.
You remembered it. Thank you. Manuela.
That
was Manuela. With Manuela here, we don't need Google. Arezzo and Fassbender have colors that are so distinctive and so contrasting that you hear possibilities that are not available in many other recordings. It's a recording that's sort of only occasionally available if you get hold of it, grasp it.
Okay, and then we've got somebody. Okay.
Yes, I'm curious to know Mahler's singular achievement was the music he composed, and yet you didn't spend much time talking about the music and his compositional skills. I'm wondering why.
Partly a matter of time, but what do you mean by his compositional skills?
Well, I mean, he was a pioneer.
He was absolutely a pioneer.
Right.
He was a pioneer in many, many ways.
I was hoping to hear more about his compositional skills, his approach to composition, as distinct from the anecdotes of his life.
I think that's probably going to be a different talk. But book me, and I'll see you there.
Right down here, please.
But if one were to give just one aperçu of Mahler's attitude towards composing, probably the most famous thing that he ever said was, music is not in the notes. That the work itself, the structure of the work, the idea of the work, is what one is working towards, and the notes then become almost irrelevant. So the melodies are merely building blocks in creating a work. And he studied, as you know, with Bruckner, and derived much of his knowledge of structure from that great source, but then worked out a very different way of filling the building and making it shine.
For Deborah, did you consider including Das Lied von der Erde when you put the Mahler project together? How did that get left out?
Yes, we did, and I mean, there were so many other things we would have liked to have included. We were constrained by something very simple and very real. Time, rehearsal time, number of concerts that we could give, and the fact that when we finish this in a week or so, we take the entire show on the road to Caracas. So we thought about it, we talked about it, but even in the most wonderful artistic moments, as Mahler had to make his own pragmatic compromise to convert. We didn't do Das Lied von der Erde.
Can I ask a supplementary?
Sure.
Mahler 10.
We did it.
You did it?
Oh, yes, okay. We did that. And it was we had a real discussion about this. We paired it with Mahler 1.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some discussion about what would go first, Mahler 1 or Mahler 10, because after Mahler 1, that's sort of the conclusion, the grand conclusion of any evening. But Gustavo felt very strongly that we had to start people with that wonderful excerpt that you just heard, and with thinking about where he was as a young man in his 20s. And we had to move to the end, the other end of his sonic and emotional universe. And when you hear what was finished of the 10th Symphony, you travel to a different planet.
Mm-hmm.
We're still breathing the same air. Mm-hmm. We're lucky about that, but it's a different planet in so many ways. So we did 1 and 10 together.
Good.
I wish we could have done more song. There's so much more we could have done.
Thank you. 3 very brief questions. Do you know what Mahler's favorite color was? We know your favorite recording. What is your favorite symphony and or movement? And who do you believe is the Mahler of today?
Color,
I can't tell that. Do you want to know what his favorite dessert was? Oh. Do not try this at home. Apricot dumplings. It's like cold cast concrete. I don't know if he ever specified a color. And since the only photographs we have of him are black and white, we can't really tell from that. I don't know. A favorite symphony, favorite movement, I don't have one. I do actually see the work as a totality. And I love to see the work as a totality. And I've once actually put it on as a totality in a single day in Stockholm. All of Mahler's symphonies in a single day played forehand piano. And it was a wonderful thing to sit through. Somebody asked if somebody was coming to all the performances here. There were people who sat from 9 o'clock in the morning until 9:20 at night listening to the whole of Mahler and actually almost having an X-ray picture of Mahler, examining him skeletally through the work. So I can't divide, I can't take one from another. I have to see them all together. And what was the third question?
Mahler of today. Who is the Mahler?
Who is the Mahler today? There isn't one. I mean, people like Mahler only come once or twice in history, don't they? You know, who is the Freud today? Who is the Einstein?
But we don't
know. And why is it? No, let me take it further. I mean, why is it that they all come together at that particular moment? Mahler, Freud, Einstein, Joyce. Why, at that particular moment in history, is the world reconceived in that way?
Question here? A question I have is, thinking about the music, the symphonies that Mahler never heard performed, do you have any idea what changes he might have made if he heard them?
All I can say is that any changes he might have made one night, he would have changed again the following night. It would always have been a matter of feeling and of impulse. The one thing that I would say is that it is a myth and a fiction to say that the 10th is incomplete. It isn't. It was left in 5 folders in a particular order. It is through composed. There is a line that goes from the beginning to the end. We do have a very good idea of how the 10th was going to go. And although there have now been 10, 11, 12 attempts to do versions of the 10th, the core of the work exists. And to say that the 10th is an unfinished work is simply untrue.
But, you know, Mahler loved to sort of fool around with things. And in the dressing room for the guest conductor at the New York Philharmonic, on the wall, we have framed from the archives, because the New York Philharmonic is now, I think, about 175 years old, and they actually saved things. So there is a remarkable archive there, which is rich in Mahler and Bernstein and all sorts of things. But Mahler took the Beethoven symphonies and reorchestrated them and added in different voices. And so posted on the wall is his changes to the Beethoven symphonies in blue pencil. And, of course, this infuriated Toscanini, as we know.
Yeah.
And he preached against Mahler. This was terrible. How could he do that? And then on the other wall is Debussy, I think, Prelude, L'Après-Midi. And it's with Toscanini, and he's added in little changes.
Right. Absolutely right. Like, first,
get right in. You see, the maestros, it is wonderful to have a maestro who is also a composer. And I mean, I think one of the great benefits to Los Angeles of the remarkable tenure of Esa-Pekka Salonen was that he saw the world through the lens of a composer, not of a conductor. And they make a difference. It makes a difference when you see that. But one thing is they have very strong opinions about everybody else's composition. But Toscanini, but we had them opposing each other on the walls.
I was wondering if after that you would talk about Mahler as a conductor and why he was described by so many as a reformer.
Sorry, I'm looking for you. I can't quite place it.
Right there, right there.
Oh, there you are. Right, okay. Yeah, yeah.
I was asking if you would talk about Mahler as a conductor and why he is so often referred to as a reformer.
Very briefly, when Mahler came onto the scene, conducting as a profession was in its infancy. We can probably trace the origins of conducting to Hans von Bülow, when he stood in for Wagner during rehearsals in Tristan und Isolde while Wagner was seducing his wife Cosima. That's the beginning that's the beginning of the history of the profession of conducting, and it also...
What one part of it?
It gives you... It gives you access to the innate ambivalence that conductors feel towards composers. This is 1865. Mahler starts work as a conductor in 1883. So it's only 18 years. And at the time that Mahler is starting to conduct, there are two big figures on the scene, Hans Richter and Arthur Nikisch, both of whom owe their origins also to Wagner. So he's one of the founders of the profession, and pretty much everything that he did sets down guidelines for what is still done today. And I mentioned at the New York Philharmonic, not just the idea of the thematic series was an original idea of Mahler's, but the idea of a season built in series, nobody had ever tried that before. Nobody had ever toured an orchestra before. Those are huge reforms. Then he comes to the Vienna Opera in 1897. At that time, it was still customary for a divan, a sofa, to be wheeled onto the stage for the soprano gently to recline upon and there to die in Aida, rather than to be entombed. The dramatic potential of opera was simply untapped. Mahler restored the authenticity of drama, and then went one huge step further by engaging an artist, Alfred Roller, to be his director of productions and to try and use light and color. You were asking about color. Yellow in Tristan, it might have been yellow. You were asking various shades of yellow and orange. To use an artist to bring out the visual dimension in opera as well as the artistic dimension in opera in a way that no one had done before. If you look at the original Wagner productions, they all seem very heavy, very encrusted, very literal. Mahler again, just about the time that Picasso was going blue, Mahler is employing unexpected and suggestive colors in the production of opera. He basically invented what we think of today as an opera production, and he did that from the position of conductor and music director. That's why we think of him as a reformer.
Hi, I have heard that prior to World War II, Karl Antrel was responsible for making Mahler well-known in Europe and the Americas, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Karl Antrel? No. Wonderful conductor, was incarcerated in a concentration camp during World War II, later on conducted the Czech Philharmonic and did conduct some Mahler, but that was the limit of his influence, and then came out and was conductor here in Toronto and died there in 1973. That was the limit of his influence. Wonderful conductor, but not one of the vanguard of Mahlerians.
Do we have one more, or is that it? All right. This will be... You get two microphones.
If I may sneak two questions in now that I have the mic. Did Mahler have certain musical idols? And who were they, if he did? And also, the repertoire that he conducted in Europe, was it essentially the same as what he conducted in the U.S., or did it change when he came to the U.S.?
Apart from Elvis Presley and the Beatles, Beethoven and Wagner were huge figures in his life. Bach was always a restorative for him. If he got stuck, if he got blocked, he went back to Bach. And he had a sentimental attachment for Mozart, possibly because Mozart died young. But he always feared that he too would die young. But he loved the music of Mozart. Those, I think, were the four great pillars. That said, the opera that he conducted most was Carmen. He was the first in Germany to conduct Tchaikovsky. And he was forever looking for new ways to break out of the mold. And he was the first to support Schoenberg. And even though he said, I don't understand what he's doing, but he may be right. So those really are the composers that he esteems most highly. What happened in America is sometimes portrayed as being a classic piece of European exploitation. Oh, here's another European maestro who comes over to America, takes the dollars and run. And in Mahler's case, that was simply not true. He was tremendously excited about it. He'd left Vienna, and he closed down that chapter of his life. But he was really excited about coming to America. He loved the openness. He loved the democracy. He loved the idea that if you happened to bump into the president on the street, you could greet him and say, good morning, Mr. President. He would say, good morning, Mr. Mahler. Or choose not to greet him, and that would be okay too. And he fills his letters with little stories of that kind. So he loved the classlessness of America. And he felt he had a real contribution to make. And when he became conductor of the New York Philharmonic, it was the first and only time in his life that he had an orchestra to call his own. And the attachment was emotional and powerful, and the investment was enormous, because he'd never had to construct a season before. He'd never had a thought. He thought and he knew about how a concert program worked and how a concert season worked. He'd been conductor of the Vienna Philharmonic until they threw him out. But that was a very, very short season. To do the full season of the New York Philharmonic and to do almost all of it himself, that was a huge intellectual and artistic challenge. And he invested enormous amount into it. And out of that, we still refer back to much of what we continue to do in today's concert programming.
Hmm. Well, as we close, actually, it gave me another thought, which is when we first heard about this fellow, now our music director, Gustavo Dudamel, he was conducting at the International Mahler Competition in Bamberg, and of course, this led to many, many, well, led to him eventually being here. His premiere, as his inaugural concert, as we said before, was the Mahler First. That was our first American tour. When we toured Europe, it was with Mahler 9. And he had been conducting Mahler since he was 12 years old. And that's why you see many of these scores. I mean, you will see all of them, I believe, in the course of the cycle, committed to memory. But it is interesting to me to think that he somehow feels a very special bond, a person who grew up, you know, in a small town in rural Venezuela, who's had a phenomenal sort of arc to his life. And this speaks to his heart. Mm. And so I think we thank you so much, first of all, for being here tonight, for coming to give your talks, and please come to his talks at Walt Disney Concert Hall. And I think
if you want to hear a compositional process, yeah, we'll do a bit of that. Okay.
and I think we've done our best to answer one question: why Mahler? Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.